This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. You might have seen them testifying on TV, the women who came forward in late January to recall the crimes of former USA Gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar. Therapists had advised the women that telling their stories might help them heal, but the impact of their words went much further than that. Reporter Anya Alvarez has our story, and before we start, we should acknowledge that this story includes descriptions of sexual assaults, and it might not be suitable for everyone. We begin on the sixth day of testimony.
When I had to approach the stand to talk, I was closer than I ever wanted to be to him ever again.
Ariana Castillo took a deep breath and told the court what Larry Nassar had done to her.
I started gymnastics at Twistars when I was around 3 years old. At the beginning, I loved everything about it.
You know, I was terrified having to see him again. It was that feeling all over again. I tried my best to focus on the judge.
I didn't think it was weird, the placement of his hands, one on my hip and the other on my butt. I just thought something was wrong with my hip when you were feeling around the inside of my thighs, and I started hurting in my vaginal area, which I assume you can all imagine what caused this.
Ariana wasn't alone in the courtroom that day. Over 7 days, 155 other young women came forward, reading victim impact statements which detailed the abuse they endured at the hands of Larry Nassar, a sports medicine doctor who worked for Ariana's gym, Twistars, USA Gymnastics, and Michigan State University.
A lot of the girls, you know, they came forward the year I was born, but everybody just kept blowing us off because we were young girls.
When the abuse happened, Ariana was 8 years old. She kept it bottled up, never telling anyone, even her mother. But in that courtroom, she found the strength to tell her story for the first time.
It took me a lot to want to speak out, but I figured if I stayed silent, I'm only letting him win.
Nancy Hogshead Makar, an Olympic gold medalist in swimming, watched from her home in Jacksonville, Florida.
I was watching on live stream, like most people were.
For Nancy, this was personal. She's a former Olympic swimmer and a civil rights lawyer, and she'd been following this story since long before most people had heard the name Larry Nassar.
So the story really began to surface in the summer of 2016, okay, right before the 2016 Rio Olympics, is when USA Gymnastics starts getting called out for how it was handling sexual abuse. So at first, it was not a Larry Nassar story. It was a USA Gymnastics not taking care of athletes story. And I've been involved in that story since 2010.
That's when Nancy first started working with the U.S. Olympic Committee to try to better protect athletes from sexual abuse.
And I thought that if they only knew how bad it was out there, that surely they would do something about it. And it took me a while to wise up that no, they know exactly how bad it is. And they want this system because it saves them a ton of money.
So as Nancy watched Larry Nassar's accusers stand up in court, she didn't see victims. She saw young women who embodied what it meant to be a survivor.
I was so impressed with how vulnerable they were and at the same time, how strong they were. You know, I kind of could recognize myself, frankly, in a lot of their stories.
One of those stories was the one Ariana Castillo told on the stand. When Ariana began training at Twistars, an elite Michigan gymnastics club, she was surrounded by some of the best gymnasts in the U.S., including future Olympian Jordan Weber.
I kind of always looked up to, you know, the older girls that were there, so I think that was just like my main goal is to be just like them.
Ariana was a very independent child, traveling with her team to Indianapolis, Chicago, and Texas. That all started to change when Ariana was 8.
And it was the very beginning of practice. I was up on like the coach's knees being stretched for my middle splits. We heard a noise, like something cracking. And, you know, just kind of wrote it off as my back cracking because that's exactly what it sounded like. I kind of noticed it felt weird to walk a little bit afterwards. They just kind of thought I had pulled a muscle or something. So I just kept going, and it wasn't until I got to my leap passes that I fell on the floor and I wasn't able to get up. That's when I really knew something was wrong.
Ariana went to the ER. They took x-rays and diagnosed her with a fractured hip. But when she went back to Twistars, her coach didn't believe her.
He thought I was faking in order to get out of conditioning or doing any work at the gym. It kind of felt like a slap in the face, you know? Here I am with an injury and they don't want to believe me.
Ariana's coaches sent her to see Larry Nassar. She trusted him.
He came off as like a really nice guy, really sweet. All of the older girls in my gym, they went to see him. So, you know, I kind of felt like them in an aspect. I just felt honored to be able to see him because he was the top doctor in the sport.
It sounds like he also made you feel really safe, like you were in good hands.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, he made all of us feel special in a way.
After seeing Nassar a few times in his office with her mother present, Ariana felt mature enough to get treatment alone.
I told her she could stay out in the lobby and I'd just be right back.
Then the abuse started.
He would say that I needed to go through pain in order to be successful, and that was just part of it. So I just kind of took it as he's the doctor, I should listen to him. After that appointment, I went and told my mom that he just made me feel super uncomfortable. I didn't really know how to put it into words exactly what he was doing. But after that, I stopped seeing him at the office. But, you know, I still had to see him at my gym, too.
Nassar worked as a trainer on Monday nights at Twistars. Coaches sent Ariana to see him for treatment in an enclosed area in a back room. Should Ariana refuse treatment, she could face retribution from her coaches.
Every time I had to see him, I just had like this gut punch of a feeling. I didn't know how to put it into words, so I just kept telling myself that, oh, you know, it's nothing. It's just me being 8. I'm immature. I just wouldn't know better.
When she was 10 or 11, Ariana left Twistars and found another gym. She wanted to have fun again, but
I was still hurting. You know, my hip was always in pain. And I figured if I continued on with a sport, I would just end up having to see a doctor again or having to be referred to him. I just wanted to do anything in my power to, you know, not have to go back there or see him ever again.
Ariana stopped competing around age 12, but Nassar had taken away more than just her love of the sport.
I didn't feel as confident as I once had before. You know, I didn't feel as mature as I did before either, because I just always wanted my parents around no matter what.
So you felt like you needed protection again?
Yeah, that's how I felt all the time, and you know, I still feel that today.
Nancy Hogshead Makar was a sophomore on a swimming scholarship at Duke University when sexual assault changed her life. The year was 1981.
It was the first day of Thanksgiving break, and I was in town because, of course, I was training. This guy starts running towards me kind of slowly, and I was uncomfortable enough that I started running into the street instead of running on the sidewalk.
As she tried to run past him, the man pulled Nancy into the woods. For over 2 hours, he sexually assaulted her. But when she started to cry, she realized that could be her escape.
I could tell that he liked it. And so I started to cry more. I felt like the whole point of this was to really degrade me and damage me and to humiliate me until I was sort of at rock bottom, and then he was done.
The man finally let Nancy go. She ran to the police and filed a report, but they never caught her rapist.
Well, there for a while, I had to stop swimming because I couldn't let my mind wander. I really had to keep a tight rein on my thoughts. If I let them wander at all, it just would move into pure panic. And I just couldn't do that and swim. So they redshirted me. So they let me keep my scholarship, even though I didn't swim. I got into 2 car accidents right away. Bang, bang. And after the second car accident, my parents were like, Nancy, just come home. Just, you know, I'm going to cry now. But they said, you know, just buy a ticket when you get there. Don't pack, don't anything. Just drive to the airport. Just get home. So I did.
After taking some time off, Nancy started to ease back into swimming. It was there she began to find healing and remnants of her old self. So when you won your 3 golds at the Olympics, was there any moment where you thought like, wow, I can't believe I overcame all of this pain to get to this moment that I achieved this?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I had lots of those moments. And at the time, I wish that I had had my act more together to be able to talk about having been raped when I won at the Olympics. But I really didn't. I couldn't talk about it at that time. I mean, I'm 55 years old and I just broke down and cried. You can imagine.
After the Olympics, Nancy realized that she could use her platform as an Olympic medalist to advocate for women in sports. She attended law school at Georgetown and began working on behalf of athletes who had been sexually abused by their coaches. That's when she discovered that the USOC and other sports governing bodies were hiding behind something called the no-duty rule. It's a legal doctrine that says a person or organization has no duty to protect another, even from obvious harm.
As opposed to, let's say I tell you, Anya, this is a very dangerous intersection. Let me help you across the street. Now you're hit by a car. Now you can sue me, right? Now I'm liable. So, United States Olympic Committee were doing that exact same thing. They knew it was a dangerous intersection. They watched person after person getting hit by a car, and they weren't doing anything.
Nancy realized the entire system needed to change.
Over the years, I wrote the policies, you know, child protection policies that the national governing bodies and the USOC should enact. And I got blocked in virtually every step of the way.
That's until more than 250 women came forward to accuse Larry Nassar of sexual abuse.
Your Honor, may I have the permission to address the defendant?
Absolutely. Proceed.
Dear Larry, it is hard for me to believe that someone who did so much good for me did it for all of the wrong reasons. This past week has been the hardest of my entire life, but listening to so many other strong women speak out has inspired me to do the same.
Larry, you are the one who should feel guilt and shame every day.
Perhaps you have figured it out by now, but little girls don't stay little forever. They grow into strong women that return to destroy your world.
By this time, Ariana Castillo was 20, but she still hadn't told her family what had happened to her.
And what was that moment like for you after you had finished reading your story in court?
It brought me a bit closer to everybody, you know. I don't think they really knew what I was struggling with. It made me feel happy to know that somebody was listening finally.
Nancy Hogshead Makar had spent most of a decade trying to get people to listen to her concerns about how little was being done to protect athletes. She even helped design legislation to close the loophole. It's called the Safe Sport Act.
So the Safe Sport Act does what tort lawyers could not do, which is it gives the Olympic Committee a duty of care. It requires them to protect athletes from sexual abuse.
Sponsored by Senator Dianne Feinstein, the Safe Sport Act passed the Senate in November of 2017. But even after hundreds of women had come forward to accuse Nassar, the measure was stalled in the House.
What changed the world is when those victims came forward and started talking. And when they, one after another, that was live streamed, that you had a judge who validated every one of those stories, those athletes were not only believed that it happened, but they were also believed in the depth of the emotional harm that this guy caused them.
The House voted to make the Safe Sport Act a law on January 30th, just 1 week after Ariana Castillo and 155 other women gave their victim impact statements against Larry Nassar. Only three congressmen voted against it: Thomas Massie of Kentucky, Justin Amash of Michigan, and Mark Sanford of South Carolina.
Can you tell me a little bit about the moment, though, when you did get the Safe Sport Act signed into law?
Oh, I'm going to choke up right now. So the first person I saw afterwards, I was working upstairs, and I went downstairs, and my son is there, and he's 17 years old. And I just, like, wept into his chest, and he was just so sweet. I was working so hard right before it got passed, and I was like, look, kids, I know I'm not winning any Mother of the Year awards, but I promise you that you're going to be proud of me. And we made it happen. This was huge. This is as big as Title IX getting passed. Every time I think about it for the rest of my life, I'm going to feel good about that.
Reporter Anya Alvarez brought us that story. Since the Safe Sport Act was signed into law, a former Olympic Taekwondo team coach has been banned for a decades-long pattern of sexual misconduct, and a veteran swim coach retired after his accuser refiled her complaints with Safe Sport. She first brought those complaints to USA Swimming in 2010. We'll have a link to Safe Sport at onlyagame.org. Former NFL quarterback Ryan Leaf knows a supportive family doesn't guarantee success in life.
If that were the case, I would have never ended up in a prison cell.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. In November 2017, Philadelphia-born rapper Meek Mill was sentenced to up to 4 years in prison for a probation violation. Patriots owner Robert Kraft and 76ers owner Michael Rubin were among those who felt the sentence was unjust, and they began agitating for Mill's release. After Mill was released on bail this past Tuesday, Rubin picked up the rapper in a helicopter, and Mill was at the arena in time to cheer the long-suffering 76ers to a playoff series victory.
Ringing tonight's bell, welcome home, Meek Mill!
That's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter for Think Progress, and by SB Nation's Tyler Tynes. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Tyler, you're first.
This was something that we needed, right? Regardless of how you feel about Meek Mill, about his music, about his incarceration, about the probation hearing, about what this symbols for other Black Americans who are going through similar things, what you can say is that for a night, Philadelphia was free. This is a 3-year process in the making from Sam Hinkie's Trust the Process version of the Sixers, a 6-year in the process since the last time they won a playoff series at home. And the city has been yearning for one of its favorites to actually finally come back. For a city as competitive as this, for a city as underdog-driven as this, Philadelphia has obviously wanted the Eagles to have their win, and they did that, and that was great. But not only do they get the city's version of Jay-Z out of jail, you get a win, and you get a massive moment for Philadelphia in their sports history and this rejuvenation of the reincarnation of how dominant Philadelphia sports are.
So I must say, I'm not typically a Philly sports fan, but this version of the 76ers is an absolute blast, and Joel Embiid is just amazing. And they're so lovable that it's even making me love J.J. Redick, and as a Carolina Tar Heel fan, that's really hard to do. And of course, Meek Mill was, that was kind of a seminal moment, and to see that happen, the only way it could have been better is if Robert Kraft wasn't involved in the story somehow.
Well, now, yeah. Wait a minute, I'm going to pick that up right there, because wasn't it kind of an indication that all manner of miraculous activity is possible, that even Robert Kraft was involved in this? Maybe even he. I mean, recently, of course, a supporter of Donald Trump, and here he is glorying in Meek Mill's freedom. It's quite extraordinary.
It's weird to kind of see something like this when you see so many white sport owners and so many white people who kind of want to impart either their money or their knowledge on a situation that doesn't directly involve them every single day. Mm-hmm. It's telling that someone like the Sixers owner Michael Rubin said that the first time he thought that there were injustices that differentiated between a Black and white America was when Meek Mill went to jail. It shouldn't take that long for white people to understand that Black people have a different America that they live into. It is refreshing to see that white people might actually care enough about Black people to throw their money and support behind a man who is not your casual victim. And it's interesting to see that, but we can't lose sight of actually how we got here. It took Robert Kraft. It took Michael Rubin. It took the preaching of white people for months and almost a year to have this happen. Imagine if that doesn't happen. Meek Mill's probably still in jail. And imagine what happens if other people who aren't Meek Mill, who don't have the fame and the money and the support of Meek Mill, they have to sit in jail for moments like these.
Lindsay, what's on your mind?
All right, I'm going to try and explain this quickly. It gets kind of complicated.
Good luck. Good luck, because I know your subject.
Yeah. So this week, the International Association of Athletic Federations, the IAAF, announced new eligibility regulations for female classifications. Now, what this does is it cuts the current testosterone threshold for female athletes in half, but only for women competing in international events from 400 meters to 1 mile. So it's just for women with naturally occurring testosterone levels higher than this threshold competing in these, I think it's about 5 or 6 events, a very small number. Now, this is not a coincidence. Caster Semenya, who is an Olympic champion middle distance runner, runs in 2 of the events that are targeted. And Semenya has been targeted by the IAAF since she first burst onto the scene and won the world championship in 2009. At that point, the IAAF broke its own confidentiality rules and announced that this South African runner was going to undergo gender testing. Now, what really makes this horrifying is the fact that the IAAF's own study from last year found that in only 5 categories did women with naturally occurring testosterone levels higher than average have an advantage. And that advantage was only 1.8% to 4.5%. Additionally, the 2 highest sports where this advantage was found were hammer throw and pole vault. But neither hammer throw or pole vault are included in these new regulations. Could that be because these are not sports that are traditionally dominated by women from the global South? It's hard to not see that as part of this story.
All we're seeing is a perpetuation of what we often see. We see whiteness imparting itself on blackness and diminishing its greatness, right? If they don't vilify or tarnish our image, they create laws to stop our greatness. And it's absolutely ridiculous that a situation like this has to amass because somebody is so dominant over their sport that they have to be vilified. It's like you're a smart kid in a class and you only get A's and your teacher tells you to cut it out because the class is underperforming. So is the problem actually with the system? Is the problem with the class? The problem with the athletics? Or are we seeing a truly generational talent be, again, vilified? And I think that's the thing, the way we kind of have to look at it is that the IAAF, just like the IOC, just like many athletic bodies across sport, have done things like this to change the laws and move the goalposts on black people and black athletes. So none of this is actually surprising to me, but it doesn't make it any less insidious.
To Tyler's point, think of how we treat Katie Ledecky's greatness. We marvel at it. We marvel at how much she dominates her competition. We don't scrutinize her body to try and bring her back down to earth. And that's how we should be treating Caster Semenya. We should be reveling at her.
All right, we're going to move along to an entirely different subject because I learned this week that Wembley is for sale. The UK's Football Association wants about $500 million for the stadium, which, of course, has been the home ground for England's national soccer team and various other wonderful things for many years. One of the potential buyers is Shahid Khan. He owns Fulham FC, a soccer team that presently plays in Craven Cottage, which is my favorite name of any venue for any sport. He also owns the Jacksonville Jaguars of the NFL, and there has been some speculation that he will move the Jaguars to the UK and they will play at Wembley Stadium. I have a problem with this for more reasons than I have time to even enumerate, but Craven Cottage may end up abandoned and derelict, which would be very bad. American football should not be exported any more than American cigarettes should be exported to places where they don't have warnings on the packages. And finally, come on, Wembley. What do they sell next? Wimbledon? The Tower of London? The Crown Jewels?
It's just really hard for me to really care what happens to the Jacksonville Jaguars, and I know that sounds horrible. I mean, I think the NFL should be spending its money and its priorities should be elsewhere. But overall, does it really bother me? Probably not really. Blake Bortles can go to London. That's okay.
If the fan base is actually there and the people do want it, then why not? Billionaires spend their money in stupid ways every day anyway. So it would be odd to restrict Shahid Khan from being able to do this. That being said, I don't really care what the NFL does with its time, with its effort, with its monies. It's not going to do anything good to begin with. There's really no energy really there to stop them from doing what they want. If they want to run Roger Goodell for president in 2020, I'm sure they're going to have a good chance to win. So it's really not up to me, I don't think, to care that much. But we are going to desecrate Wembley. Wembley's a beautiful place, and it should be only for soccer and some other things. But if the NFL says they want to go to Wembley and mess up Wembley, you're going to have an army to stop him from doing it.
All I have to say to that is Roger Goodell will never run for president because the pay cut he would have to take would be just restrictive, I'm afraid. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Think Progress's Lindsay Gibbs and SB Nation's Tyler Tynes. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Remember Philly. It's always Philly.
When NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell took the stage in Dallas on Thursday night for the NFL draft, fans booed him, as they always do.
Thank you all for being here.
And then something happened that had never happened before. Four quarterbacks were taken with the top 10 picks. Everybody knows you can't often win without a good quarterback. That was also true back in 1998 when a kid from Montana heard his name called. But not every top draft pick turns into a winner on the field. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Ryan Leaf doesn't think that people are necessarily products of their environment.
If that were the case, I would have never ended up in a prison cell. You know, I grew up in a really supportive environment. I had two amazing parents, two younger brothers, grandparents, a supportive community, really loved.
Leaf's hometown of Great Falls, Montana, was like many towns throughout the U.S., at least when it came to how it treated its star athletes. By the time Ryan Leaf was 13, he enjoyed the view from a very high pedestal.
I was told how great I was at something, and I tended to believe it. I thought I was a god. I was more important than you because I could do this thing, or I played a silly sport that made me a better human being in my eyes.
As a junior quarterback, Leaf led his high school football team to a state title, but...
I wasn't the popular jock. I was the guy that showed up at the party with a six-pack of 7-Up, not a six-pack of beer. I looked at people who drank and did drugs as morally corrupt. It's ironic, of course, to where I ended up.
Ryan Leaf went on to star at Washington State University. In 1997, he led his team to a Pac-10 championship and a berth in the Rose Bowl. He was a Heisman Trophy finalist that year, along with eventual winner Charles Woodson, Randy Moss, and fellow quarterback Peyton Manning.
Who are going to be all Hall of Famers, I believe.
From December to April, debate raged around the country concerning which young quarterback should be the top choice, Manning or Leaf.
Welcome to the National Football League's 1998 Player Draft.
On April 18th, 1998, Leaf was sure he had it made, whatever the draft order.
I was going to play 15, 20 years in this league, make millions and millions of dollars, win some Super Bowls, and ride off into the sunset. This was a goal I had set, and I was about to achieve it.
With the first pick in the draft, the Indianapolis Colts select quarterback, University of Tennessee, Peyton Manning.
San Diego was next on the board.
Ryan Leaf.
With visions of success, money, and prestige dancing in his head, Leaf began the 1998 season as the Chargers' starting quarterback. He won his first two starts.
And then I ran into just a buzzsaw in the Kansas City Chiefs in Kansas City.
Leaf completed just one pass in 15 attempts. He threw two interceptions and fumbled three times. The Chargers lost badly. After practice the following day, Leaf confronted San Diego sports writer Jay Posner in the Chargers' locker room. Posner had reported the day before that Leaf had verbally abused a Chargers employee.
Don't talk to me, all right? Knock it off!
Later that day, Leaf read a scripted apology scribbled on a piece of paper.
I misdirected my anger after the Kansas City game. I was extremely disappointed in my performance, and I let it show.
With an obvious smirk, Leaf tossed the written apology into his locker before astonished reporters. No one had been fooled, and the damage had been compounded.
And how I reacted after that game was what ultimately sealed my fate. It was a caricature of who I was for a very, very long time.
The Chargers finished the season 5-11. Leaf became a whipping boy on sports talk radio. And he became angrier.
I felt like everybody was wrong. I felt like I was the victim. I felt that it was everybody else's problem, not mine. That's how drug addicts behave. And I was a drug addict long before I ever took a drug. You're judgmental, you're fearful, you're angry, narcissistic, all of those things rolled into one. And when you're battling the best defenses every weekend, you can't be battling the media every single day.
In three seasons with the Chargers, Leaf would win just four games as a starter. San Diego cut him in early 2001. He learned about it in a newspaper while on honeymoon in Tahiti. Over the next year, Leaf played for Dallas and got shots with Tampa Bay and Seattle. but new environments did nothing to improve his play or help him fathom his lack of success as a pro. Ryan Leaf retired from football in 2002. He was just 26 years old. What Ryan Leaf wanted most was to simply fade from the public eye. And he managed to do that until he attended a fight at the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas.
And the MC was announcing celebrities in the audience. Charles Barkley, Tiger Woods, Dr. Dre, and the MGM Grand just cheered and applauded. And the MC announced my name, and the whole MGM Grand just booed and hissed. That had happened before, of course, just as an opposing quarterback, but you always have this armor on, the helmet, the shoulder pads. This, for whatever reason, was more about me as a person. It was just kind of sliced open and filleted for everybody to see, and that night would change my life forever because of what would happen next.
Leaf attended a post-fight party.
An acquaintance of mine was there. He offered me some Vicodin. I, of course, knew what Vicodin was from my orthopedic surgeries during my playing career, and this would be the first time that I would take them in a recreational way. He gave me two pills, and I mixed them with my alcohol that night, and it did its job. It was a painkiller. All the emotional pain that I was in disappeared. Every morning I would wake up, and the first thing in my brain would be, do I have pills? And then once I took them, I didn't feel anything. And I could just disappear and live in this foggy ether of nothingness.
Leaf lived in that ether for most of the next 8 years. During a 3-year stretch, he was arrested multiple times on burglary and drug charges. The last arrest came on April 1st, 2012, a day Leaf calls the worst of my life. It began when he woke up at his home in Great Falls and noticed that his painkillers had run out.
I looked up ways to kill myself.
He tried slashing his wrist with a knife, but couldn't follow through with it. So he drove to his parents' house, where he planned to asphyxiate himself in their garage. But his brother Jeffrey had found the towels that Ryan used to clean the blood off his arms. He called ahead. When Ryan arrived, cars blocked the entrance. So he drove past the house in search of more pills. He broke into a nearby house and stole some. When he returned home, the cops arrived. He was tried and convicted for burglary and criminal possession. Leaf was sentenced to 7 years in prison. He served the first 9 months in a lockdown treatment facility.
I was just as miserable as I ever was in my life, you know. Just because you remove a substance from somebody's system doesn't mean they change. Because I was doing nothing. I was as self-loathing as ever and angry and judgmental and just fearful of everything.
Until he met a cellmate who was a veteran of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And he said, because Ryan, you're going to get out at some point. This is what we're going to do. We're going to go down to the prison library, and we're going to help prisoners who don't know how to read learn how to read. And I went begrudgingly, and I just went back the next day, and I went back the next day, and before I knew it, I had realized that I was being of service to another human being for the first time in my life. And I knew that it was going to have to be the foundation for when I got out.
And he came to another realization.
I was there because of what I did, no one else. And I was forced to see it in a lot of the people I was surrounded by. People who could not hold themselves accountable. I had a roommate once who simply kept telling me over and over that he wouldn't be in there if it weren't for the woman that called the cops on him. And I asked him why she called the cops. And he said, well, I beat her up. And I said, well, maybe that's the reason why the cops were called, because you were assaulting her. They have blinders on, and I must have been exactly that same way for so long in my life, especially when I was a professional athlete. I couldn't see what was outside me, and if anybody ever tried to place that mirror in front of me, I just removed them from my life.
Ryan Leaf was released in 2014 after serving 32 months in prison. He's a new father now. He covers Pac-12 football on radio and television. In 2017, he started a foundation for people who can't afford substance abuse and mental health treatment. And he travels the country to tell his story.
I was in Longview, Texas recently, and I was talking to a group of young adults who were incarcerated. And when I made the statement to them that they were just as important as Dak Prescott.
Prescott is the highly successful quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys.
There was a shocked look on many of their faces. They don't see themselves as another human being at the same level as somebody like him.
Ryan Leaf's mission these days is to convince people that they are as important as celebrity athletes. He's qualified for the job, and doing it has led him to a new perspective.
I defy anybody to be of service to another human being and not have the most peaceful night of sleep you've had in a long, long time. Those ideals that I thought were important or what I thought success was have been replaced completely. If I do the next right thing on a daily basis, not just good things happen for me, but great things.
And if he doesn't do the right thing?
I end up in a prison cell.
That story was reported and produced by Only a Game's Gary Wallach. 100 years ago, a women's soccer team in northern England started drawing tens of thousands of fans and the attention of male soccer officials.
They clearly became very concerned about this rise of women's soccer, and I think there was literally a fear of competition with the men's game.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Listen to the news and wonder, is there anything good happening out there? I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And each week, Guy Raz and I take you and your kids on wild adventures to explore the most wow-worthy news stories on the planet. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of a boy, a baseball, and a future world leader. But right now, it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Gandhi?
We're going to leave it right there.
Okay. All right. I wasn't sure. Kurohito?
The second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs has begun, and what a beginning for the thoroughly amazing Vegas Golden Knights. They beat San Jose 7-0 in Game 1 of their series. How far do you think the Knights are going to go in the playoffs?
They're going to win every Stanley Cup until well after I'm dead.
Astonishing success.
Yeah, you have to really see it to believe it, to be honest with you.
The Sharks roster features defenseman Paul Martin. 14 years he's been in the NHL. He's been in the playoffs 14 times, but he's never been on a team that won the Stanley Cup. I know you would like to see Vegas go all the way, but it would be nice if Martin got his name on the cup.
Poor Paul Martin. You know, if he retires without having won the cup, they should let him touch it.
ESPN's analysts felt the Trailblazers would ground the Pelicans in their first round series, and nope. The Pelicans had some fun at the expense of the analysts, I guess.
Yeah, the Pelicans went on Twitter and essentially fed it to the ESPN analysts, who underrated the fact that Anthony Davis is a really remarkable basketball player.
Well, I'm glad they did it when they did it, because they play Golden State next.
Hey, I'm not entirely sure that they can't beat Golden State or at least give them a really good series.
The NCAA's Commission on College Basketball has called for, quote, sweeping change. No wonder the commission has characterized the current, quote, environment surrounding college basketball as a toxic mix of perverse incentives to cheat. What changes are we likely to see?
Well, the biggest one will not happen, which is to blow up the NCAA and construct something more sensible. This is all window dressing. It's an attempt by the NCAA to further control high school basketball players, which is obscene. And once again, it's ignoring the basic issue, which is going to make the sport collapse eventually, which is pay these guys. I mean, this is a commission designed to avoid that Armageddon, which they can't avoid. It's coming sooner or later.
The first round of the NFL draft took place on Thursday.
Your excitement is really hard to handle.
Anyway, any winners or losers you want to talk about?
Well, neurologists everywhere had a big night, as always. I mean, you can't tell. The Browns took Baker Mayfield, the quarterback from Oklahoma, which is making everyone very unhappy. I think the New York Giants did very well getting Saquon Barkley to run the ball, which will, you know, hopefully keep people off Eli Manning. But you won't know who won the 2018 NFL draft until 2020.
Wyoming quarterback Josh Allen was chosen at 7 by the Buffalo Bills, despite a tweet history as a high schooler that would be embarrassing even to most high schoolers. Is Allen that good? The Bills overlooked this stuff, didn't care?
I don't know that he's that good. I mean, I don't know how long you should penalize somebody for tweets they made in high school. The tweets are really awful and offensive, and somebody excavated them for Yahoo Sports. But I'm sure the first interception he throws, he'll hear about them again.
Who knew that tweets could be excavated?
Well, we're now getting the first generation of athletes who grew up tweeting.
Tweeting, but not being smart enough to know that they would never go away.
Everything is forever on the internet.
Right.
Even old people know that.
On Wednesday night, the Miami Marlins beat the L.A. Dodgers and their Cy Young-decorated starter, Clayton Kershaw. One guy who really made that happen was the Marlins starter, Trevor Richards, former substitute teacher and brewery employee. So I guess you could say he schooled Clayton Kershaw.
You're having a bad day. First of all, it's an 8-6 game, so it wasn't exactly a pitcher's duel.
No.
But Richards struck out 10 of them Dodgers. And by the way, even though he was a substitute teacher and he worked at a brewery, he has his cliches down pat. I just focused on keeping the ball down and attacking the zone early, throwing strikes and looking ahead. As you remember, the famous incident in ball four where the pitcher comes to the mound and tells Bouton, throw strikes, and Bouton comments, if I could do that on command, I wouldn't need a pitching coach.
And finally, Charlie, Boston Bruins forward Brad Marchand had 34 goals and 51 assists in the regular season and, of course, helped his team advance to the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. And the NHL has asked him to stop licking opponents. And I don't understand. Well, I can lick any man in the house. That's, isn't that the attitude?
No, that's not what they mean. Apparently, Marchand has more than a little golden retriever in him, Bill.
Oh.
And likes to lick other players and nuzzle them and, like, kiss them. And I know. I mean, it's an extraordinarily weird habit. I think maybe if they could, like, give each of the opposing players a milk bone, maybe they could get him to sit or stand or roll over or something. This is unquestioned.
They don't want him to roll over. Hockey, it's a Stanley Cup playoffs.
You don't want anyone to roll over in the Stanley Cup playoffs. I really don't want to know what Brad Marchand's going to do with the Stanley Cup if the Bruins win.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Phil.
In 1917, at the Dick Kerr Company in Preston, Lancashire, England, business was booming. World War I was eating up all the munitions the plant could produce. But even in those dire days, there was time for recreation. The Dick Kerr Company, like lots of shops and factories and towns in England, sponsored a soccer club. One day during a lunch break, the men who were still at work rather than in uniform were practicing, and the women who'd been employed when the supply of male workers began to dwindle were looking on. Here's Professor Laurent Dubois, who teaches a course called Soccer Politics at Duke University.
What we know about it is that the women who were watching were not that impressed, and so that's the beginning of the story, really.
One of those unimpressed women was Grace Sibbert.
She just laid down a challenge, in a sense, which was to say, you know, we probably could do better than you at this game. Soon enough, they played a game, and I think partly what happened was that other women realized that they would really enjoy playing this game.
So the Dick Kerr women's soccer team began with a challenge and the discovery that soccer was fun. And shortly thereafter, with the arrival of a worker named Lily Parr, it got serious.
She was very young when she started working at the factory, I think 14, a kind of tough worker, and she just seems to have been this incredibly intense forward. Clearly a very kind of threatening and intense presence at the front of that team.
How threatening, you may ask? How intense? Preston, Lancashire's own Gail Newsham can answer that. She grew up close to the site of the Dick Kerr plant, and her writing about the women's team includes a particular Lily Parr story.
They were kicking in and warming up before the game, and there was this professional male goalkeeper watching them. He went down to their end of the field and he just said, you'd never score a goal past me. Well, you didn't really talk to Lily like that and get away with it. So she said, all right, then, you know, you get in the goals and I'll take a penalty against you. So she put the ball on the spot and ran up and took a shot at him and put his arms up to try and save it. And the power of his shot broke his arm. So he was then crying, somebody take me to hospital. She's broken my arm. You don't mess with Lily Parr.
The Dick Kerr women's team took on all comers, female or male, and became a popular attraction.
It's really kind of expands and booms, and part of the fact is that a lot of the audiences are men. Men are going to these games. There's accounts in Gail Newsham's book of really, really large games.
How large?
The biggest crowd that they played in front of was at Goodison Park, Everton, when 53,000 people came to watch them play. And they were between 10 and 14,000 locked out, unable to gain admission.
That was perhaps too many people for the Football Association, which was and is in charge of the game in England.
Just my own opinion, but I think the 53,000 at Goodison on Boxing Day 1920, I think that was an alarm bell for the establishment. It was really quite big, and I think probably that's why the FA then chose to ban them from playing, because they were getting too successful.
At a time when the Football Association was expanding and energetically promoting the men's game, what could be more sensible than banning women from the pitch? Laurent Dubois shares Gail Newsham's take on that policy decision.
They clearly became very concerned about this rise of women's soccer. And I think partly that there was literally a fear of competition with the men's game. And I'm sure, you know, obviously just a more ingrained sexism in the way they were thinking about it. They obviously could not ban women from playing soccer on their own when they wanted to, but they took away kind of all of the infrastructure that had been sustaining these leagues and these places, saying, you know, they can't use the official pitches. If you were a referee, you weren't supposed to referee a women's game, so forth.
Rather than take their ball and go home, the Dick Kerr women's team got on a boat and sailed across the ocean.
When they arrived in Canada, they were told that the Dominion Football Association had refused permission for them to play there.
Oh, Canada, would that you had been more glorious and free. The Dominion Football Association's decision meant the Dick Kerr team would have to cross another border and find men's teams to play against in the U.S.
They weren't too happy about it, but they had to agree, and they played 9 games. They won 3, drew 3, and lost 3.
Despite, or perhaps because of, the success of the Dick Kerr team, the Football Association's ban prevailed until the late 60s, and it caught on. The German Football Association banned women's soccer from 1955 until 1970. In Brazil, which has recently produced several of the game's most accomplished female players, women's teams were banned from 1941 until 1979. Obviously, the Football Association's initial ban was bad for the women who wanted to play soccer and the people who wanted to watch them, but it was also bad for anybody who cared about maintaining a complete record of the culture of women's sports and women in general.
The FA sort of succeeded in kind of erasing that legacy and silencing it. And even FIFA today sort of presents itself like they're almost like supporting a new thing, right? When we understand that they were there in the early 20th century, that they were playing, that they had the success, I think that gives us a very different way of thinking about women's soccer today.
If the triumphs and popularity of the Dick Kerr women's team had not been buried, maybe it's pointless to speculate about how much further along women's soccer might be. Better, perhaps, to celebrate with Gail Newsham how far the women's game has come since all those bans against it were finally lifted.
It is growing, and it's wonderful to see. You know, we have professional women footballers now, and that's something I couldn't even dream of when I was young. I would give me right arm for the opportunities that they have today, that's for sure.
Gail Newsham's book is In a League of Their Own, The Dick Kerr Ladies, 1917 to 1965. Laurent Dubois has written The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer, and we'll have links to both books at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Sousa. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from Duke professor Laurent Dubois, who remembers the victims of the policies that banned women from playing soccer.
They lost out certain ways, but it's really the rest of us who lost out, I think.
Would that it had been otherwise. What do you say we get it right from now on? I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.